Thanks for tuning in to the Medivac Podcast, powered by the Robert Irvine Foundation, whose mission is to support and strengthen the physical and mental well-being of our nation's heroes and their families. I'm one of your hosts, David Reed.
And I'm your other host, Christian Myers. Thank you very much for joining us today on the Medivac Podcast. If you're new here, there's a price for the show. You have to share it with a friend or family member if you get something out of today's episode. There's a lot of good information in today's episode. Our guest today is Brendan Quisenberry.
Welcome.
Welcome. Thanks for being here,
dude. Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. Truly appreciate it. This is awesome.
Of course. Yeah. Brendan is a near 20-year Army veteran, rounding that corner here pretty shortly. He's been a Green Beret for a majority of his career, currently in 20th Group, and he is also the executive director of the Transcend Foundation. We'll hop into that a little bit later. But yeah, thanks for being here, Brendan.
No, thank you. Yeah, pleasure to be here, guys.
And you guys flew in.
We did. Probably one of the rockiest flights that we've actually had in a while. They were like, got up on the mic right away, and they're just like, hey, guys, it's about a 2.5, 3-hour flight, and it's going to be primarily turbulence the entire way.
Hooray.
Really?
Yeah. And where was that? Was that like, did you guys go through Dallas?
No. It was a straight flight, straight from Detroit to San Antonio. Okay.
Which is surprising.
Yeah, I searched for that one. I wanted to get straight. I hate getting the layovers and whatnot. So
yeah. Oh, that's the worst. Thanks for being on the show. And before we dive into Transcend, I always like to ask the question of how you got interested in joining the military. Was it family, or what inspired you to join?
Yeah, so definitely, I'm third generation family member. So my grandfather served and was a tanker. And then my my dad was an MP for a while. So we won't hold that against him. But, you know, and then so it was definitely generational. But I never really felt that pressure, I would say, for joining. I guess it wasn't like this heavy thing from my father or anything like that, that you have to join per se. It was something from going back as a kid that I can remember that I just thoroughly enjoyed being that kid running around the neighborhood, you know, playing in the woods, all that stuff. And it was, you know, freaking watching, I mean, Rambo and certain movies and all that I loved. And I knew that that's what I wanted to do at like probably, Rambo. I don't know, that's 7, 8.
Classic example of just horrendous post-traumatic stress. And I'm glad that that really inspired you. I could use some of that.
So it's funny because the irony of First Blood, right? Like it actually wasn't Rambo at the time. Like the movie was legitimately called just First Blood. And the whole movie that we all love, right? He's running around the woods. He's just tearing up the sheriff's deputies and all that. And it's great. Like how they kind of have the whole setup and everything. What I didn't really realize at the time, because I don't think I fully appreciated it, but his speech at the end, when he's there, when he's kind of more or less defeated, all the people are surrounding him now, and he's in this police substation, and he actually kind of has this outrage, like burst of anger and all that stuff about just kind of like, they don't know who I was and what I did and this, that, and the other stuff. But like, it was, you know, kind of an interesting, like, you know, him PTS moment, I guess, as he was kind of sharing that with, you know, Colonel Troutman and all you know? And, it just, that's something to me growing up, that part was skipped over because I didn't understand it. Right? Sure. I didn't really fully know what was going on there. I just liked all the cool stuff in the woods that was happening, right?
Blowing shit up and
didn't realize this is domestic terrorism.
No.
But it's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
I recently watched Rambo First Blood, or just First Blood, as you called it. Yeah. And I was very surprised at how that was so popular. Because I was like, this guy is a terrorist and he deserves to be thrown locked away.
Yeah. Well, they tried to lock him away, you know, but he got up and out of it.
He just murdered all the deputies. Yeah. So I guess
it was inspirational.
Yeah. It's funny. So you joined the military, because of Rambo. Yeah. But and was it Army that you always knew what you were going to do? Did you even know what Special Forces was at the time?
I mean, you know, again, really like basic about saying that terminology, you know, Special Forces, you just knew that they were like some elite guys that just ran around the battlefield that blow shit up and, you know, did some really cool stuff, but you know, I couldn't differentiate what a SEAL between a Green Beret between, you know, I guess you didn't even really know much about what Delta might've been doing or something, but, sure. Something in that kind of elite nature, I guess, as you will. will. And that was just one of those movies at that time that just happened to kind of like kick it off for me. And then I just never really wavered. I mean, like I said, I saw that movie, which by the way, as we were looking at it, and my son now is approaching 8. Oh, and
about the same time.
Yes. Huh? And I'm like, I would not show him any of these movies at all. And I don't know what my mom was thinking, like, let me watch that stuff. Yeah, I don't know if she cared or
it's like Saving Private Ryan, right? Yeah. One of the most heartbreaking movies if you understand it. Yeah. Right. But yet at the time you're like, I can totally do that.
No. When I was young, just always wanted to go in and serve. Mm-hmm. And again, a little bit of that just family, you know, being able to actually just serve. I continue the legacy of serving within my family and everything, mm-hmm. right? And that was all pre-9/11. Mm. And then when the towers, you know, happened and 9/11, you know, happened, it was at that point in time, and I was still probably a good 70-80%. I was going to go in, you know, college, of course, I'm starting to think about it at the time. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, which is really just probably just going to party and all that stuff. I didn't really care about anything else. Mm-hmm. And, but no, once the towers fell and all that, like I knew I was going in like that 100%. And that's, that really solidified.
And how old were you at the time?
I was a junior in high school.
Okay. So definitely.
Yeah.
Realizing what you're going to get into right off the bat.
Yeah. No. And I remember
you had 2-3 years to go until you enlisted.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. No. So it was, and also kind of following the, you know, intro into Afghanistan and kind of how the missions went down, like with the Green Berets and kind of that Tora Bora and, mm-hmm. and hearing about those initial ones, 2001, because it wasn't until the end of 2003 I signed up, and then 2004 I actually physically went in, because mm-hmm. I was in the DEPS delayed entry program at that time. But, mm-hmm. It was fast and furious. So I did have a couple of years of it to kind of morph, and you kind of saw on the battlefront and, mm-hmm, and front lines of what was going on.
Got over the horses and you know, went straight to Humvees without armor.
Sandbag armor Humvees. Which I feel like the horses were probably the better option, you know? I don't know. Yeah. Those Humvees were death traps. I mean, So,
was it everything that you expected? I mean, you heard the stories from your grandfather was in World War II as a tanker, you said.
No, not in World War II. Okay. Actually, he was at the tail end of... Yeah, he actually wasn't physically in World War II. It was, I think, like 47 to 50 timeframe, right around that time. Yeah. Okay. And so, no, he just missed the tail end of that. And then my dad was right around the Vietnam timeframe, except he was in Germany, kind of on the Berlin Wall when all that stuff was going on. Yeah. And East Berlin and all that as well. So it was... I don't know, actually. Yeah, what was the question?
I was just saying, you know, what his experience was and like how that inspired you to kind of make your choice.
Yeah, I didn't get to talk to him that much. So grandfather wise, you know, I was probably 7-8 when he passed. So I never really got to talk to him about any of that. And ironically, my dad too, like even to this day, he shared some stories with me, but it was, he probably shielded a lot of that as well. So he didn't really ever church that up that much. And that was like, I don't know, 4 years-ish in the, you know, MP unit over in Germany and all that. Had some pretty cool stories and traveling and all that stuff that he had some pretty interesting stories on. But he didn't really share a whole lot of that with me before I went in before that. So it was kind of interesting because it was probably, I would say, like maybe a decade into my service when me and him finally kind of sat down and had some kind of back and forth interesting talks on each other's time and service and whatnot. So it was just, again, no pressure from them of me going in and serving and all that.
Nice.
Mm. So you ended up joining in 02 or 03?
No, I signed in 03. Okay. I actually officially went to boot camp in 04.
Okay, so 04. And then what was your first job
in the military? 82nd. So I went into airborne school, knocked that out, went over to 82nd Airborne, and then we ripped right into Iraq, actually. Okay. So the tail end of that, by the time I got out of basic airborne school and in process into 82nd Airborne Division straight over to Iraq, was probably about the tail end of 04 and into 05. So we were there for supporting the elections. Okay. And I mean, literally I was about, you know, 18, 19, like my senior prom was like 6 months prior. And now I'm in the streets of Baghdad as 11 Bravo infantry guy, you know, kind of going house to house. So that was a pretty big wake up call from, you know, an 18-year-old kid to,
absolutely,
to, you know, from high school to that. It was pretty quick.
Yeah. It's a massive transition.
Yeah.
What was your first deployment? Like, I imagine that was a 12 or 15 month.
So the election, so it was a 3-monther. So we just got deployed, I guess, to go support the elections at the time. So it was just a quick, it was actually a quick in and out. I think they were already over there. So they actually kicked me and a handful of guys that just in process to catch up with the unit, which is always a great time because then you're a brand new guy into a new unit where, like, as soon as you get over there, of course, they're just, you know, going to crush you and, and you're just the brand new cherry and all that. Is it swearing cool on this podcast?
Yeah, you're fine. Okay, cool. You're totally fine.
But yeah, just totally got over there and you're the brand new private and they just, you know, it just crush your soul and you, but you also have to like wake up fast. I mean, for good reasons too,
yeah, of course.
Right? Whether you call it hazing or whatever, but I mean, you had to be snapped, you know, switched on at any given time because I mean, yeah, you're right in life or death situations.
So. It's interesting to see the difference of today's military versus kind of during GWAT, if you will, as well. I mean, nowadays you talk to someone and you're like, hey, you could potentially be deployed for 15 months. They'd be like, you're out of your mind.
Yeah.
Right. It's like now it's like, oh, no. So we have feelings now in the military, which is wild to me. I mean, so it starts like that off in the beginning, right? You only deploy for like 3 months and then it starts transitioning after 2005 really heavily into like 15 month deployments. And, I mean, that's got to be its own inspiration to go special operations, right?
Yeah. You're like significantly shorter deployments and everything. And, you know, it's like, hey, these guys get to grow their hair out and
more well trained.
Well funded.
Sign me up for
you
that.
You know, the stupid excuse of like, oh, well, you're not going to be able to, you know, don your PA, your pro mask. You know what I mean? And it's like, when's the last time we ever used those? And if anything, shit's gone really bad. I remember like, you know, we're running, you know, 10 miles with our P mask and kit on. And I was just like, I just remember like almost throwing up in this mask, just being like, if this ever happens, like shit's gone real bad.
Yeah.
It's a problem.
So, I remember, well, it's funny. I remember when we were prepping for, so I was down to seventh group at this point in time. So this was like 2016, you know, Trump's president. And there's the banter back and forth between Kim Jong-un and Trump.
Yeah.
And all, of course, all that stuff's going on. But we're like, no shit, like getting ready to possibly, I mean, this might go down. We might go to war with, you know, North Korea. And I just remember some buddies of mine, you know, and at this point in time, I'd already had several combat deployments under my belt, but they were like, oh my gosh, yeah, we're going to go. And I'm like, that's going to be a nightmare. Yeah, like, that's not going to be good. They have been defending themselves for, you know, 50, 60 years, like just well-established trenches, like all the subterranean warfare. Like
this is,
it would not be easy at all. And we would have a lot of casualties. Like,
you know, like, I just said today is, you know, all these people in power have access to history books, right? We are just doomed to repeat everything over and over again. We should have learned this, right? From World War II. It's like, you know, and we were accustomed in Afghanistan to see how a bunkered in force could be. And yet, you know, they didn't have the air power, air support. They don't have the technology that we have. And still they were giving us a run for our money. You know?
It's a conversation, a topic not many people address, the fact that, you know, we were funded billions and billions of dollars and they were funded by a couple hundred million at most, right? Between their entire organization. We have F-16s and we have drones and they have crushed water bottles for shoes half the time.
Like,
fighting a near peer is going to be a much different conflict. Even with North Korea, I wouldn't consider them a near peer, but still, like, much more well-equipped, much more well-prepared than our current enemies of the GWAT time.
So I mean, I'm sure that's what you've seen in your kind of later service as well, as just seeing the threats that are there, right? I mean, China, that's a whole nother topic in itself, but North Korea, we're China, we're Russia now, like all of these major players have very different, you know, very different tactics that, you know, we're not going to go in and kick ass anymore, right? We're not, you know, we're kind of throttling down into peacetime mode, but yet we're not.
No, so we had our head in the sandbox for 20 plus years while China was just going to town building out their infrastructures worldwide, you know. And we, I mean, interesting enough, though, there's things to that now. I mean, we really, I mean, really finely tuned our tactics in GWAT. I mean, the what we were. I mean, you know what? Actually, my best example of all the units, all the special operations unit, everything, the unit that evolved the most, I would hands down to say, is Ranger Bat. I mean, they, you know, I hate to say it, but like kind of out of the shadows of, you know, CAG security bitches to what they've, to morphing into CAG Light and what they're like precision and their surgical DA hits and what they can do now is just night and day blown away from like the time of GWAT kicking off into where they're at now. So, I mean, there's been a lot of evolution of tactics, TTPs, things that we've learned over time to finely tune from being like a blunt hammer object to like a fine surgical scalpel to how we can like kind of hit and deliver, you know, certain things. So we've definitely fine tuned and tested our TTPs over that time. Oh, yeah. But on the flip side too, we were just so buried and so isolated into just that region of the world that everyone else was starting to kind of morph and evolve with their stuff. And we weren't staying on par with them as they were growing and evolving as well. And then here we are. I mean, we are behind China in that kind of race. And there's a lot of things that they're doing a lot better at than us on that scale. So
proactively and quietly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So, oh yeah. Demoralization and destabilization. That's what they're doing.
Yeah.
Destroying the male population here, right? Just everybody's red cards all day long.
Yeah.
You know, I can't, my feelings hurt. Mm-hmm. My feelings are feeling. So let's discuss the differences you've seen in those, you know, tactics, techniques, and procedures within 82nd versus, you know, what you're doing now.
Yeah.
With group.
Me and Ernie were talking about this not too long ago, just the evolution of CQB. You know, we were first got into Iraq and, you know, Baghdad, and you're taken, you know, like city square block by city square block. And I mean, so you're just taking this massive infrastructure and everything. And we literally, I mean, it would frag the room. Like, you had no idea. You would throw a frag into the room, it would blow, and then you would go in and we would strong wall. I mean, that was a technique of ours at this time, which, you know, we can look at today and be like, what the hell were we thinking? You know, but like, you know, same wall and just dominate that side of the room into clearly what it's kind of morphed into today with CQB and how precise it's really become with all the it's a game of angles, you know, and just maximizing those angles and being able to, you know, it's just kind of flow and everything.
It transformed into that like kind of pool player versus just like, you know, kick the door in and just go, you know, just, yeah, that's how it was in the beginning. You just remember just whatever furniture was in your way, you just took it down. Yeah. It's like, stay down.
Yep.
When you go in, you fucking trip on your face, just stay down.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, it's just really, it's morphed a lot into the TTPs. That portion of it's been pretty interesting to kind of see it come along and actually to kind of flip that on, you know, a tactical standpoint for that, like just looking at health and fitness. I mean, you remember just, you know, my time coming in 04, it was, you know, run 4 days a week, ruck once a week. And you were just pounding that pavement and it was the same old every other day. And I mean, just terrible for us, just crushing our knees, like longevity within the units and all that was just, it was terrible.
Yeah. Right.
And to see it come into now to where some of like the Thor-Thee programs. And I remember the first time I heard about foam rolling and like, I started this like 2007, I think. And like, I started rolling out my legs and stuff on this foam roller. And I was like, this is so stupid. Like, I can't stand this. It hurts. I'm like, I don't want to keep doing this. And I didn't realize, like, understand the full science of like what it was doing. But like, as I got into doing more foam rolling and just that kind of the evolution of fitness and as it evolved for like health and longevity for the soldiers. And it wasn't just all about running and rucking every time. Like, it was kind of interesting to see that morph into the like modern day PT to what it is now. And I think the Army's new program, which is like H2F, holistic health and fitness.
Yeah.
And so that's pretty cool on, you know, it's spiritual, mental, physical, social, emotional health issues that they're starting to focus on, right? So it's not just about physical fitness and being that stud. I mean, they're really trying to round it out and do a lot better job on that front on a complete holistic health standpoint and longevity of the soldier over time. So even just the way, you know, kind of health has morphed over time, but tactics, techniques, the way that it's just kind of shifted has been, it's been pretty interesting from my time in the 82nd to, you know, 10, 12 years into special operations now as well, to how much it's really kind of changed.
Yeah, the sports medicine has changed dramatically, especially over like the last 10 years. It's taken
a
giant, you know, giant leaps and bounds, and seeing that applied to the military now is, I'm very, very happy to see that. Yeah. doing a better job at taking care of their investment. They spend all this money on training us and making sure we're prepared, we're properly equipped, but you know, they're missing all these other aspects that can help prolong the lifespan of, you know, the people that are investing all these dollars into.
Yeah.
Turning and burning people aren't a priority anymore. Yeah. And, you know, that begs the question too, is there's gotta be some sort of balance to that, right? I mean, if you bring individualist mentality into the military, you're going to have people start to be a little bit more abrasive. They're going to speak up right when you're trying to get them in line. So what's the balance there?
Well, from
why does special operations do it so much better than conventional?
It is, well, for one, it starts with the selection process, right? I mean, so first and foremost, they have a pretty good idea of what they're looking for and what they want to achieve within those people. And then as long as those kind of metrics are met, then from there, they can kind of train them into whatever they need to be trained into. So it's, I can't really go into specifics on some of that stuff on the selection process to specifically like what they kind of look for. Cause some of that is kind of close hold, but there's a handful of things that traits and characteristics that they're just looking for at individuals right out of the gate.
Childhood trauma,
pretty close to sociopaths. I mean, they're like, you're a sociopath. Let's bring you in. Yeah. You'll be good.
You would potentially be a criminal, so we're going to give you a job here.
Exactly. Yeah. So pretty close to that, actually. So not too far off, honestly.
it is. Yeah.
It's pretty close. Special operations, organized crime.
I always do say the military is a cult.
Yeah.
It is a cult if you really think about it.
Yeah.
It's just a very successful one.
It is. Yeah.
It's government sanctioned.
That was kind of my reaction the first time I had spent any time around the Team Six guys. Was we spent a lot of time around conventional SEALs and they were, you know, pretty standard, and the Team Six guys walked in, I'm like, who are these fucking criminals over here? Because they look like absolute criminals. Well, that was kind of this consensus
like
we had.
Dogs too. Like, you'd think like these guys are just going to be Jack Diesel all the time, but they're like, they got the CrossFit bodies and the just flowing locks. And like, hey man, is gel issued to you as well? You know?
Yeah, definitely for the SEALs. I'm sure that's a unit issue. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, book deal.
Yeah, it was with their pen too. And the blank book ready to go.
I know. Yeah. Yeah, their book deal. Welcome that's upon exit in the military. Man, that's got to be, it's a terrible reputation to be forming, you know? Yeah. And that's, that begs the question too, is like quiet professionalism too, is, you know, something that we discuss across the board is when you start to get to those like higher levels in these units, and we see it consistently on all of our guests that talk, is there's a sense of humbleness that comes with these types of individuals. And I think it really drives the fact of in order to be the best student, you have to be willing to learn. And if you have that sense of arrogance to you, how are you going to be open to learning anything? So you cap yourself off at that. So that filter process starts happening as you go up too.
Yeah. No, right? Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Wild.
It is, yeah. So you went from 82nd Airborne, you transitioned into the teams.
No.
The group?
Oh. No, no. Oh, so
let's hear.
I did a handful of rotations with the 82nd Airborne. And then at that point in time, it was actually one of my last deployments over to Kandahar. It's like 2009 timeframe. And
rough timeframe out there.
It was. And I mean, just the height of the war in general too. I think there was like 120,000 DOD people over there at any given time. So I mean, it's just tons of huge US footprint over there. Yeah. You know, which makes it a target rich environment for bad guys, you know? And, so lots of IDs were just being littered all over, you know, the grounds and everything. And, people were getting blown up like left and right. Like I was in HHC 2508 scout platoon at this time.
Okay.
So I was in a scout sniper section, and lots of our companies were just taking massive hits. And luckily we had some pretty good missions and where we would recon and set up and do our, all our recce stuff, and a lot of the other, right around this time frame, if you remember, some general comes up with the concept of like present patrols. We're just going to walk around and we're going to create a presence in the most heavily mined place on the planet.
Excellent idea.
It's great. Lord, you know, and there was probably some, you know, OER bullet comment for that, where he got probably pinned a star, you know, for that concept, whoever that might be. But yeah, the dumbest concept, clearly. And the guys were just getting, you know, just blown up left and right. And so my unit, we took a lot of casualties on that. And then near the tail end of my deployment, my platoon was fortunate enough up until that point to not have any casualties of any form until we lost one of our snipers, Chris Moon, and just pretty much blown up like right in front of us. And so that was rough. That kind of really hit us all hard. And I remember it was at the tail end. I mean, you know, we're talking like weeks from us returning back home after a 12-month deployment. And ended up coming back home, and it just, the whole 82nd concept at this point, I'd been like 4 or 5 years at Fort Bragg at this time. So I just was burnt out and I had to get the fuck out of there.
Sure.
And, so I called Ranger Branch up at this time and, you know, I was like, hey, I just need to get out of here. And so they were like, where do you want to go? I was like, I don't care. So they're like, well, how about 101st? They're light infantry. That's probably right up your alley. And I was like, sure. Yeah, send me. And so I go over to the 101st Airborne Division.
Okay.
And of course, my unit that I signed into was already forward deployed in Afghanistan. So they asked, they're like, do you want to go? It was respectfully, you know, it was like a hell no.
Yeah.
And luckily I was in my dwell time, so I was able to not go. But then.
Sure. Yeah.
So I was actually talking to Ernie about this on the way over here. So I was rear D first sergeant. So I was an E6 at this point in time. So I became like rear D first sergeant, right? So just running rear detachment, which is just, you know, you're basically chaptering guys out of the military that just don't want to be there, and doing the casualty assistance and, and all the funerals and stuff that you would have to be a part of. And so that was pretty much what I had to do as like rear D first sergeant.
Which is not something you want to jump right back into.
No. It was, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That was rough because it was already going through a loss of ourselves. And then now I was playing different roles of to which casualty assistance piece of it that I needed to play, anywhere from a pallbearer to like delivering the message to whatever
and,
the case.
And at that point too, is like, you're not a part of the team yet.
Yep.
You know, you're not.
Exactly. Yeah. And so now I'm like, I'm over there and these are guys coming back like from my unit. I haven't met any of these guys yet, but like they're coming back and well, I mean, you know, and with flags draped over their coffins and everything.
Sure.
And it was just, that was rough. So that was about a good 3-4 months long. And finally I had a couple buddies in the 101st at the time. I was like, man, what, I was just burned out. I was like, what do I got to do to get out of here right now? And he's like, well, you're not aerosol qualified, right? I'm like, no. He's just like, oh, go hit aerosol school. So I was like, all right. So I went down to
2 weeks. Yeah, like, yeah. Thanks,
toughest,
man.
Toughest, you know, 10 days in the army, they say.
This is the stupidest comment in the world.
Yeah.
Same with airborne school. I was drunk every single day I went. Yeah. Except I got the shin splints from that fucking airborne shuffle everywhere.
Because it was so slow.
It was so slow.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You walk faster than that.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Speed this pace
anyway,
up.
Anyway, yeah. I digress.
No. So yeah, they toughest 10 days in the army there with aerosol school.
Fucking stupid.
And so it knocked that out and it was, you know, so I was like, oh, cool. And I was just happy because I was away from the unit. I wasn't chaptering guys out of the army anymore and I wasn't doing the casualty assistance. So I was just like, man, all right, just a little bit of a break. And so it was cool. And then, so they had Pathfinder school. So I just turned and applied for that and went to Pathfinder school. And then they had Fries and Spies Master. So I knocked that out. And then they had Rappel Master. So I knocked that out. And I was just knocking these schools out left and right. And during this time frame, the 101st parachute demonstration team is also training out of the Sabalowski Air Assault School schoolhouse in 101st Airborne Division. Yeah. So I started talking with the parachute guys. And at this point in time, before I left out from Fort Bragg, went over to Fort Campbell, I got my A license out at Rayford. And so I got my first, you know, 25 jumps, A license and everything, tested out as a civilian, and then went over to the 101st. So now I'm, you know, got some basic jumps under my belt for free fall. And then I started talking to those guys and they're like, well, hey, do you want to come try out? And I was like, yeah. And so basically the stars, the moon, everything had to align to make that happen. So basically I had to go ask my sergeant major if he would release me to this skydive team to go over there and like lose me as like the rear D, you know, first sergeant. And then at this point in time, I'm Ranger, Arslick, Sniper qualified. And then I just hit all those four schools.
Yeah. All these previous schools.
So I literally, I took like my uniform. It was like sterilized. Like I took everything off my Ranger tab off everything. And I just like went up and asked him, I was like this slick E6 trying to look like the biggest, you know, dirtbag ever or something, like, hey, get rid of me.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, again, like I said, the stars, the moon, everything aligned. He just got back. He was retiring after like 30 years of service and he just did not care. Yeah. And he's like, what is it? He's like, we have a skydive team. Like he had no clue. And I was like, yeah, just sign right here, Sergeant Major. Yeah. And so we did. And he released me to go try out. And so I went to tryouts. I made it and then was on the 101st parachute demonstration team, which is the oldest skydive team in the country. It's actually older than the Golden Knights. 1958, the 101st Airborne Division parachute demonstration team stood up. 1959 was when the Golden Knights stood up.
Wow.
So it was actually the first one of its kind. And so it was pretty cool. So I got to be part of that. That was 3 years, non-deployable. And I was just traveling all over the U.S.,
jumping
my ass off. Yeah. So, I mean, we were doing, you know, probably 50, you know, 70 jumps a week.
Wow.
It was a great time. So I got my pro rating license and then I started, so the first year you basically you're kind of like a ground bitch. You're learning, you're jumping every day, you're learning kind of how to, obviously all the parachute packing, you're learning the narration. Mm-hmm. And so the narration, when you're the ground guy, is you basically, when our guys are up in the air and they're about to jump, you're the guy on the ground at the 50 yard line with a microphone that's like, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the 101st Airborne Division, I am Staff Sergeant Quisenberry. And I'd like to take this opportunity to rep, you know, and you're like to, you know, Tennessee Titans, Detroit Lions football game.
Sure, yeah.
You know, 50, 70,000 people right there. And like you're narrating in front of the stadium. And so what's interesting about that is like you have to time it right because now you're timing like the jumpers are out and the smoke is on. And like if the aircraft is like kind of delayed or whatever and you have ground crew and you have people that are kind of like, they're like, ah, they're still like, you know, like 30 seconds out or a minute out. And so you have to come up with filler at this time. So now you're like, you're off your speech and now you're like, please, you know, take this time to recognize Christian Myers, who's our ground guy. Christian waved everyone and you're coming up with all this filler. Just
taking some time.
Yeah. And you're just buying time until, you know, you're waiting for the jumpers to get right on course and they finally jump out. And so that whole first year is, it's a nightmare. It's tough.
And what years did you join
this? 2010, 11, 12.
Okay.
So you got a great break.
Yeah.
I did.
You got a great break.
Much needed.
And that really helped you reset a little bit.
It did. Yeah. Mm. No, it fell in love with a new hobby.
Oh, yeah.
Fell in love with skydiving, still in love with it to this day. And coming up on 7,000 skydives here pretty soon.
Wow. Just a couple.
Just a couple, that you know.
Insane.
But no, it was great. And then the first year was rough. That back half of the second 2 years was great. Jumping into football games, baseball games, air shows. Yeah. One of the most memorable ones I did is we went over to, we did reenactment World War II Market Garden jump.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wow.
So that was really cool. So we went over to Holland and, did some of the jumps over there and everything and Netherlands and all that now. And, it was just pretty cool to be a part of that whole thing. And
how did that look? What was the layout to that?
Oh, we were the only Americans there. And so if you look at the footage and we're going to watch the videos, after this, I'll show you our videos and all that. It was all the people from the Netherlands and everything were the reenactment people. Hmm. So they had all this 101st airborne get up, everything. They even packed their own T-10 Delta parachutes. Like they had their own parachutes. They did their own jumps. Got like static link qualified, I guess. I don't know how the hell they did it over there in Europe. And it's just like civilians that are just so much respect for what America did at that time. Cause I mean, they liberated them from the Nazis. And I mean, so like, it was just really cool. So they loved the essence of the 101st Airborne Division.
So I'm sure like how were you treated like royalty when you were there?
Yes. Like so much so that like the mayor of Eindhoven in Holland was like passing his daughter off to us. Like, you're like, oh, meet my daughter. You're like, hey, well, hello.
Yes, I shall pay the dowry.
Yeah. So, no, I mean, it
three
was great.
Cows, yes.
Yeah. Three cows, yeah. Two pigs, and a goat.
Sold.
It's terrible.
So, no, it was great. It was, but
we
it was
think
really,
we got it bad now. I'm just saying.
It was pretty cool to kind of see how much they appreciated our history. I mean, we could talk to a lot of Americans today that probably don't know that much American history on World War II, and let alone them, like they pass that down through like their kids and all that. It's pretty cool to see that kind of respect. So so that was my time on the team.
Can you imagine though that for real?
No.
That battle. Oh.
Yeah. No. And that does take us to American Veteran Center. This year, they're honoring Band of Brothers. So every year it's like American Valor. It's like a large military gala that they do. Last year was kind of neat. Me and Ernie went out to it, but it was, they honored like A League of Their Own, the women and the baseball and all that. And this year it's all the Band of Brothers guys. So they're coming back up and honoring like all those guys. So it's pretty cool. And actually got to, back to my time on the team, skydive team, I got to meet Dick Winters and all that before he passed, literally.
No kidding.
Yeah. So it was like right around the same time frame that like met
we
him
salute
that year
the rank, not the man.
Yeah, I love
that's right.
That.
Yep. That's right. No, that was great. That was a great show. Great show.
Oh man. Yeah. That's intense. That's an intense one. I could only imagine, that kind of warfare where I rewatched the Pacific.
Yeah.
That one's brutal.
And you just imagine that. It's just like, just hit the beach and keep going. Yep. Different type of warfare.
Those guys are just on another level.
It happened at like the time in history where it was just the most devastating damage could be done. Mm-hmm. Like just enough technology to just be inconvenient.
What was the World War One movie that came out recently? I mean, that one.
All Quiet on the Western Front.
Yeah. I mean, that one painted a brutal picture of World War One.
Like the invention of the tank and what it did to.
Yeah. And that essentially, I mean, there was a different mindset back then. People understood that their life was being given for something greater. Like when you signed up, you were expecting to go die. For a greater cause than yourself. And that's hard to find these days.
Well, I mean, we talk about this all the time is like during the time is like, what are we serving now? Like what is, you know, worth defending besides your family and all this stuff? Definitely not the political climate.
Yeah.
You know, you gotta have faith in your leaders.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a whole nother tangent. We don't have to go down.
Whole other box to unpack. Anyways.
We have to unpack that after I retire out.
I
could say it. Yeah. I'm retired, but
I'm retired. Yeah. So you went from the parachuting team and then made your way into special forces from there.
Yes. Well, yeah.
How was that experience? We don't need to get into like Q course and all that stuff. We've heard that a couple times, but what was that experience like? So you had a nice break from the infantry side. You got to go experience and do something fairly unique within the Army. Not many people get an opportunity to go be a part of the parachuting team.
Yeah.
And then you decide you want to take it a step further than you did previously with infantry.
Yeah. And it's funny too, because at the tail end of my career, and it's good that it was like only 3 years long anyways, to kick people back off to regular units and back to the military. But at that point in time, I was ready to go make that next jump that I always want to do, back to my kid days, back to like, okay, what's the next, you know, ladder to keep climbing up and everything. So yeah, joining, you know, special forces and going to test to see, you know, if you have what it takes to make that. And so that was heavily still there at that point in time. I mean, I went over there and it was, like I said, I think there was about 430 guys that started off in selection, and you know, like 86 of us were like left at the tail end of that.
Yeah.
And,
how old were you at the time?
I don't know, about 27, I would say. Okay. I think, about 26, 27,
Okay, that's pretty normal time for people to go in, right?
Yeah, no, I think I was probably a little more senior than most. I mean,
A couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I had almost a decade under my belt at that point in time as a senior E6 kind of going over there, so it was you know, the leadership, the, you know, big Army and leading, and then obviously SUT and, you know, SEER tactics and all that stuff. I'd kind of already done a decent amount somewhere in my military career. So that kind of flowed pretty naturally, pretty easily. It was actually a good time. Like I really learned a lot. The Q course was really good. I enjoyed it. Yeah, it was pretty good. The bonds that you make in those guys, to this day, still heavily, you know, a lot of my Q course friends are still like super, super tight and everything. So
those are lifelong friendships, right?
Yeah. No, it's pretty cool.
It's much like a deployment. It's like
shared
suffering.
Yeah.
Yeah. Creates lasting bonds.
Yep. Oh, it sure does.
I do want to talk about something specific, and I'm not sure if you're going to be able to share it or not. I'm going to just put you on the spot, but I know you've done some red cell stuff in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how sensitive that stuff is, but I find it incredibly interesting.
Yeah. So doing some like red teaming and everything, can't get into the specifics or the sites or anything like that, but that every so often there's different teams that get selected to be able to kind of penetrate, do some penetration testing for physical, you know, and government infrastructures around the U.S.
Yeah.
And so
I want to do that with TSA every fucking day. Just like, you know, just going to put this dildo and gun in this bag and see what happens.
Well, you know what? That brought up something. So when I So real fast, and we'll get back to that. When I first got onto the team, of course, you know, you're the new guy on, as a Green Beret, you're the new guy on the team and everything. And I remember the first time that I went through, like, so I just can't remember what training it was that I went to, but I had to like fly out and go do something. And so I had all my gear, everything packed. And of course, my senior on the team was like, make sure my layout and all the stuff was ready. So dress right, dress. And he's looking at all the shit. And then he's like, all right, you're good to go for the thing. So I was like, great. And then I just packed my shit up, went home for the night. All my stuff was there. And then I just, you know, got on the flight the next morning. Well, so I go to the airport, and then of course, you know, my carry-on bag, and I set that through, and sort of alarms buzzing, going off and everything. So, you know, I'm like, what the hell? Okay. And I'm like, I don't know what's going on. So this TSA starts unpacking my thing and then pulls out this giant, like, you know, kind of thing wrapped in tinfoil.
Oh no.
And I'm like, what the heck? And I wrapped it up. And it's a giant dildo that's in my, my bag that's wrapped in aluminum foil. So it like just sets all the bells and whistles off and everything. And, so that's always fun when the TSA agent's like, sir, is this yours?
Holding it for
you. You gotta answer with confidence at that point. Hell yeah.
Yeah. Give it back.
Hell yeah. It's mine. Can you get your filthy paws off of it?
So yeah, that was one of my first intros with being on the team after a couple months. So,
that's not hazy.
You know, practical pranks were always good.
Yeah. It's just pranks.
Yeah. That was, we did the same exact in Rangers, was like this, and we've said it several times on the show too. It's just this double-sided horse cock that literally you would, because you'd have these platoon battles, you know, with Rangers and, you know, they just strap you down with the 550.
Yeah.
And you would beat the shit out of their bellies with this huge thing. So big. This thing was so big that it broke. It did break on someone's belly.
Damn.
And I'm like, and that's the infantry.
Different type of hazing.
Different type of world. You know, it makes you stronger,
it
right?
It really does. Like
the only place you can't be happy about your birthday.
Yeah.
You know,
that's right. Oh yeah. It was always around the birthday time. Yeah.
We ran over somebody. Like he ran over, this guy like announced that it was his birthday and he runs back to his car and the whole, I mean, just a horde of like zombies of Rangers just like go after this dude. And he like just drives through the crowd. I'm like, that is great. Like you can't get away with that anymore.
Definitely not. No, I think we were going back to our days on like, I mean, we threw a guy out in like his, sleeping bag, like from the second floor, and like tied him up. And like, nice. I mean, like the thing could have snapped and could have fell like two stories and broke his legs or something.
We
you know?
Put
and,
a private in a duffel bag and hung it over the third story. We didn't drop him though.
Yeah.
There was one point though, that one of my favorite hazing stories ever, this was right when I pinned on five. I come out of the office and they have this private who is upside down, duct taped to a ladder. And one of the other privates is wiping a just dirty, wet mop on his face while another one has a boar and they're rubbing his head with it, the boar cleaning kit, right? And I'm like, what the fuck are you guys doing? Just wacky shit like that all the time. Cocoa powder, like, you know, whatever. You throw it, all this stuff on people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Hazing.
Yeah.
It is a thing. It's part of initiation, though, right?
It is. It is. It builds character.
Earning your place.
Yeah.
Earning your place.
Yeah.
Initiation. So, okay. So, like, during your time in, you see the difference between, you know, conventional infantry and your special forces time. How did those deployments go for you moving forward?
Well, it was interesting. So, generally speaking, there's six teams in a special forces company, right? And you got your 1, 2, and 3 teams, which are usually just, you know, kind of like line teams, as you would call them. And then your 4 Halo, your 5 your dive team, and your 6 sometimes your PE ASO team. And what they try to do in group, but it never lines up, is, you know, kind of kick everyone to like line teams first, and then maybe they get a Halo slot or a dive slot or something else. But of course, it never works that way anyways. But briefs well. you know,
in theory,
but, in theory. Yeah. But, no, so I went straight to an ASO, PE team. And so that was pretty interesting because now you get into like advanced special operations techniques. You know, at this point in time, SF like kind of has a divide of like, all right, you're going to go DASR heavy, mm-hmm. or you're going to kind of get into this ASO world. And of course, everyone joining SF or whatever still wants to continue to go DASR heavy and run and gun and do all that stuff. So it's like a 70-30 okay. of like mix of, you know, kind of getting in there. And of course, I was no different. I was like, yeah, let me, you know, go into Safawic and eventually Sephardic and DASR and all that. And but that wasn't the way it went. And so they sent me straight over to an ASO team, which is kind of doing a lot more tradecraft stuff and again, advanced special operation techniques, you know, kind of like pilot team stuff that you're kind of going into and doing. And so that was pretty interesting to get more into learning and navigating the human terrain, as I would call it, and then kind of dominating like the human world and kind of getting into, it was pretty neat. I mean, the level two and a lot of the trade craft and everything getting in there was kind of fun. Like I really enjoyed that. And what most people hate in the SF world is when that portion of it is kind of fun, but when you get back, you have to do cable writing. And so you have to write all these reports. And that is definitely the most boring part of whatever just took place and happened. You have to detail everything down to the gnat's ass of that. But obviously the 15 minutes to a couple hours of fun that you're having doing the tradecraft stuff is where everyone tends to love. So I got heavily involved in that with my ODA. And so my first couple missions, I mean, right out of the gate was what was called the RAT mission. I mean, it was like regional assessment teams and it was basically you're running sources and all that right away. So that was, about as much as I can say on that side, but it was a pretty interesting aspect to like, so I didn't go straight into, you know, SF, like kind of DA heavy or unilateral operations, working with our partner forces down range for my first handful of rotations at that point in time. So it was very like people centric and kind of more individual based, honestly, with a lot of that stuff. So,
fantastic.
So that kind of was, that kind of was the road and route I took into that intro into that.
That sounds very exciting in its own manner. Like DA, you know, kicking doors, shooting bad guys. It's cool. It's cool stuff. But the tradecraft style, it's more like spy kind of work, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. You're gathering intelligence on the ground. That sounds pretty interesting. For me, at least, it sounds incredibly enjoyable.
Yeah. And honestly, like, so even, you know, to where do you think like a ranger, you know, gets his target packet from?
Yeah.
I mean, how did that morph into what it did? I mean, it's usually from guys collecting that information, running sources that puts him like, hey, here's the bad guy's house. And this is who's, you know, is on the objective. And then boom, you guys go hit it and take it out. But all that prior prep of everything was like the intelligence and targeting cycle of kind of running that, getting that intel and developing it out and everything. Yeah. And it's time consuming and boring to a lot of degrees. But it is very interesting.
Like everything else, it has its like 7 seconds of excitement.
Yeah. So no, but it was this. I enjoyed it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it came into play much later where it helped me out in another aspect somewhere else I went with an agency in particular that was kind of pretty beneficial for a lot of that tradecraft that I already had under my belt.
Sure. I'm sure those skills are applicable.
Yeah, before I morphed into that side of the house. But
Well, we'll brush past that because it's something you can't talk about.
Sensitive.
Yeah. Sensitive.
But yeah, so we'll talk about your transition into working with Transcend and now being the executive director of the Transcend Foundation. So obviously you mentioned your interest in sports medicine and recovery started fairly early in your Army career, you know, around 2007 you mentioned. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that stuck with you and began to develop, especially as you got into more special operations and jumping all the time. Then you got to take care of your body if you're making your paycheck with your body. And,
you
know, if you're using it to work. So where did that transition happen? How did you get into it? Talk about Transcend a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I guess to really kick off where Transcend kind of started for me before I ever knew it started for me. Was when I was ETSing out of 7th Special Forces Group and I was going straight into the National Guard. So this is circa 2018-ish timeframe. Mm-hmm. And as I was pretty much getting ready to leave and come off active duty service, just out of nowhere, we had a team of like SOCOM docs, you know, come out and embed with like my ODA for like a month.
Okay.
And it was just kind of random and weird. We didn't know what was going on, but they just came in and that was part of it. Like they were just part of the thing. So we were like, okay, cool. So they tested all of our biomarkers. They were like with us going to the gyms. They hooked us up to sleep and heart rate monitors and everything. They were collecting all this data on us. And I had, you know, no clue why. None of the team guys, none of us knew why, but, you know, we were just told that they were doing it at this point in time. And so a month goes by and then everything, and they're, you know, calculating all this data, and they finally sit you down at the tail end of this, and they're like, okay, you know, we collected our research and everything, and we're going to go report this back to SOCOM. And, but they're like, you know, sitting you down, they're like, well, so Brendan, you have, you know, low testosterone, low vitamin D, low DHEA, thyroid issues, you're pre-hypertension, and you're not sleeping very well. So I've like got a
just list of shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Great. Thanks,
I guess.
Thanks, Doc. Yeah. What can I do to get better? Yeah. You know? And they're like, well, there's nothing we can do. We're just here to report the data. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, okay. All right. Well, and then of course, you know, docs leave or whatever, and this is all individualized as they're telling you, you know, this specific information, but then you're like, what the hell, man? Like, God, there's no way I suck this bad. You're like, hey, Christian, hey, how'd you do?
Yeah.
And you're like, low testosterone, low vitamin D, this, that. And then you're like, Dave, man, how'd you do? And like just same thing. And you're like, common theme here. Like, yeah. Okay, what's going on? Like, trends. Why are our hormones so depleted and everything? And so that was my first kind of wake up call to it. Mm. And so then I ETS out of off active duty, about 15 years active duty service. And then I was just burned out again. So back to group, multiple deployments at this point in time, I just got burned out. Yeah. Kind of, I was starting to go into divorce number two, with Nikki at that point in time, wasn't looking good. And it was just rough and kind of to some degree, a little bit of ultimatums and kind of like turning my life around and just getting more time with her, the kids at this point in time, two kids now. So I had to like really kind of reconsider and think about, you know, some priorities. And
sure.
So eventually I was like, you know what? All right, let me go into the National Guard. Let me roll my time into that, but not lose out on my retirement and all that. Went and did that. And then I have all that latest and greatest information on my hormones. And what did I do with that information? Nothing. I go contract for 4 years and you know, I don't do shit about it until pretty much, you know, I come back and I'm actually in a gym and I run into pretty much this guy here and we're both hitting it off at the gym. And basically we kind of get into, Transcend. And he's telling me about this hormone replacement therapy company that he runs. And I'm like, kind of thinking like, oh yeah, like I remember we had this huge issue with SOCOM guys that were severely depleted with hormones at this time.
Oh yeah. I feel like shit.
And by the way, I feel like shit too.
I haven't slept in 10 years.
But yeah. What's that like? Yeah. Can you balance that out for me? And, so no, we basically kind of, you know, me and Ernie really like just hit it off. Actually, it wasn't a job interview. It wasn't anything at the time. It was just a couple of vets getting together, hanging out, shooting the shit again. And then you start to develop that problem, right? You're just like, once again, you know, like the VA is kind of, you know, they do the best they can, right? But there's just a lot of issues with that.
Yeah.
And then you have these other foundations that stand up and do good causes and everything. But, you know, again, it doesn't always address everything. And so literally the same mission statement that he's running with his company, the for-profit side, it's like, you know, his idea is like, what if we take that same model and tweak it to the nonprofit side where we can help veterans and first responders and be able to balance their hormonal health out for them as well and everything. And so that was almost kind of like the inception of how that pretty much happened. And then he asked me to kind of run it and lead it, which was great because I had no clue what I was doing. And so, you know, just kind of had to figure it out each and every day, but that's, you know, that's kind of what people do, I guess. So, it's been challenging, but also a lot of fun. And that kind of is a little bit in the inception of like the Transcend Foundation that's kind of spun off and more from the Transcend company for-profit side into the Transcend Foundation and then helping veterans and first responders, you know, identify and address the invisible wounds, you know, and what are they, you know, PTS, TBI, endocrine deficiencies, hormonal imbalances. That's a lot of things going on with service members.
I would be interested to hear for the audience some of the stats that we're talking here, right? We hear all the, you know, all the time, it's one out of every three men, which is actually closer to two out of three men nowadays.
Yeah.
Right. So what are some of the, like the commonalities? What I want to do is kind of educate our audience into like, it's okay to ask for some help. Right. And that's a big thing too, is you talk to people about this. It used to be this taboo subject of like, I don't want to tell anyone that my hormones are low. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so how do you navigate those waters? And what are some kind of words of encouragement, I guess, if you will, for those that need this kind of therapy?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I'd say that it's a common problem amongst a lot of heavily in the SOCOM communities that I'm tracking and aware of, which, you know, clearly that easily trickles down into a lot of just regular active duty units.
What do you think that is?
Testosterone is one of the biggest ones, hands down.
Yeah, but why? Know? Why are we seeing that?
Oh, because, well, I mean, so it's a no-brainer for me. And as we look at it, you know, to any doctor as well, like you cannot continue. It's the constant of perpetual stress, mm-hmm. right? You can't keep going into, you know, flight and freeze mode all the time, knowing, you know, when you're going to live, when you're going to die, reverse cycle, right? So now you're doing missions at night, you're sleeping during the day, you're already throwing off your circadian rhythm, you're not getting your vitamin D. You're just under that constant stress, which will just automatically just start to throw your hormones out of whack. TBI, let's get into TBI. So whether you're in a blast of some sort, or maybe you're not even a blast, you're blowing the door, right? And you take a little bit of the door charge, and or you're firing Carl Gustav rounds off something. So there's a lot of different things where now you're getting, you know, micro doses of traumatic brain injury. And then what is actually kind of located within the brain is the pituitary gland. Mm-hmm. And so the pituitary gland, which is kind of like the mother hormone of all, you know, regulates all the hormones. When that takes a little bit of the rattle in the head, it's going to self-regulate a lot of other things within the body and throw that off too. Mm-hmm. And so the worst part about what we're seeing now is that it's just a slow drip with hormone deficiencies with service members, right? It's enough to irritate us, but it's not like a blown out knee or a back where it's like, oh my gosh, I have to go in and get this fixed right now, right? Like
it's the invisible wounds that...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you can suffer through.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so,
you did for 4 years, obviously.
Well, it's probably decades prior, but without ever knowing it. That's just when I got led onto it.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, you, it's just that slow drip of irritation. And then we're our own worst critics because now we're like, well, I'll suck it up and drive on, right? This will buff out tomorrow, you know? And you don't realize it because you can't really see it. You don't know how to address it unless you do a comprehensive blood work panel on something. So you're just not sure what it is. And then you're like, well, I'll just work out harder or I'll just do this or whatever. And then also we're high, you know, again, what is that issue? High alcoholic intake is not good for it either.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's a lot of issues that stem from us kind of creating our own problems within. And so that's a lot of the key indicators right there.
I think that's interesting and important to note as well. So I think that we're going to dive in very deep into Transcend and the foundation on our next episode.
Awesome.
But want to just thank you for opening up and sharing your story. And it's been quite a pleasure getting to speak with you. So thanks.
Yeah, you've had a very interesting career, Brendan. Seems like you've been afforded some cool opportunities that you rose to the challenge and you capitalized on those. So kudos to you and what you're doing now with Transcend Foundation. It's pretty amazing. You know, the opportunity you're affording to service members and first responders, it's needed. It is necessary right now. So thank you to both you and Ernie for what you guys are doing. And thanks for sharing your story today, man.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. And I'm literally just turning one chapter of the book over from one to the other and just continuing my service on to another platform. Yeah.
That continues.
That's what it's all about. Yeah. Continued service. Yep. So we appreciate what you're doing. And I think that that's a earmark of what we talk about on this show as well, is that continued service and paying it forward, right? We got to take care of our left and right, and we're going to still strive to do that. Yep. So important stuff. And I think it's really important to note is that we have to start addressing these invisible issues. You can't just rub dirt on everything.
No,
that's right. No. So
where can people find you on online, social media, website?
Yeah, www.transcendfoundation.com. Our webpage is up and operational right now, so getting a little bit built out, but it's coming together really nicely.
Cool.
Fantastic.
We'll send people over there. There's going to be a link right under here you can click on to find Transcend and Transcend Foundation. This has been the Medevac Podcast, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us today. Remember to hit that share button, engage with the video, because we would do the same for you.
Thanks. That's right. Bye. See you next time.
Awesome.
Cool.